anemia, which is a low level of hemoglobin, the oxygen-carrying molecule in your blood, is an amazingly common problem around the world. It's reckoned that one in three people globally have anemia. It's particularly a problem in children, particularly in poor countries. And there are lots of different causes of anemia. Common cause is almost certainly iron deficiency. So iron deficiency anemia is sometimes how you pick up bowel cancer. It should be how you pick up bowel cancer or stomach cancer, where you've got a tumour in your bowel and it's bleeding. And you don't notice it's bleeding, and progressively you lose blood and you turn out to be anemic. Not a good way to diagnose cancer, but it is one way. There are various causes of iron deficiency anemia, but you can get vitamin B12 deficiency anemia. You can get autoimmune disease, which breaks open the red blood cells, what's called a hemolytic anemia, where the red blood cells are destroyed by the immune system or toxic drugs. And then a significant proportion of people in the world have genetic abnormalities of the hemoglobin itself, which are thought to have evolved to protect you against malaria.
Oh, this is the sickle cell anemia.
Or thalassemia, or another condition called G6PD deficiency, which are common around the Mediterranean. The malaria parasite is carried by the red blood cell. And if the red blood cell is fragile, it doesn't carry the malaria parasite as well, breaks open and protects you against malaria. The hemoglobinopathy, the problem with your hemoglobin, can be a very serious disease in individuals. So the side effects of having that gene are significant. But you think, well, you go to the doctor and the doctor will often do a blood test on you if they're worried, if you're saying you're tired or something like that, and will check you for anemia. You might be surprised to hear that there is no consistency around the world and sometimes between laboratories as to what constitutes anemia.
It's just vibes. It's just anemia vibes.
It's just an anemia vibe. You're looking a bit peely. As we would say in Glasgow, you're looking a bit peely wily hen. we better do your hemoglobin. What we like to do on the Health Report is introduce new words to you.
Technical medical terms and also Gaelic.
Yeah, the pluck, the hauk, and now being peely wily, and maybe it's your anemia hen. So an Australian group have actually got together to say, look, what is a healthy hemoglobin? Because they're saying, well, are men different from women? Are kids different from men and women? Is it different if you live in the Gambia in sub-Saharan Africa or Britain or Australia? Or is it different if you happen to be ethnically Indian or Pakistani? That's what they've looked at. And the person leading the group is Professor Sanrine Pasricha, who's a hematologist at the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute and the Royal Melbourne Hospital.
What we can say is, firstly, if you do have anemia, if your hemoglobin is low, the first thing is we need to think about why that might be. And then once we figure out what the cause of the anemia is, and there are many, then the appropriate treatment can be given.
Okay, we'll come back to that later. What you seem to have found in this study is that the level of hemoglobin that's normal is actually lower than traditionally doctors have been taught.
Firstly, what we've established that it actually changes across the life course and it differs between genders. 130 grams per litre is probably okay for men, although we did maybe sense it might even be higher in men. But in women, it does look like it's a little bit lower, 120 grams per litre for women. And then what we also saw was that if you follow children, their hemoglobin concentrations increase over time. And so very young kids, we found they actually need lower hemoglobin concentrations. And what we found is that in young kids between, say, 6 and 23 months of age, the hemoglobin threshold there should be about 105 grams per litre, rising to 110 in older kids, and then increasing as they reach adulthood.
Some would say, well, are you just normalising, in some senses, the abnormal? So if women truck along at 120, does that mean that they're more marginal in terms of their hemoglobin level? Sitting behind all this is how much iron you're storing in your body to actually manufacture the hemoglobin. And does that mean if women's so-called normal hemoglobin is lower than men's, that they're trucking along with lower iron levels and therefore are more on the precipice than men are?
Yeah, that's an excellent question and something we reflected very deeply about. And you're right, that's been an area of controversy in the literature. So what we did actually in our analysis is we actually specifically looked at iron levels in men and women. And what we did was we said that to be healthy, you needed to have the same iron level between men and women, which was what was defined as an iron level that clinicians would consider normal. And we only included people with those adequate iron stores in our healthy population. But to actually test that further, we went on to progressively increase that cutoff for iron up and up and up. And even when the iron level was pretty high, we still saw a very consistent difference between men and women. And we think, therefore, that that's not driven by iron, but probably driven by hormonal differences between men and women, particularly that men have higher levels of testosterone. And we do know that testosterone increases your red blood cell production.
That lower level for women persists after menopause?
So our data goes up to 65 years of age, and it does look like that lower level does persist. But one of the gaps in our study is in older populations, and we do feel that's an important area that needs further work.
So the bottom line here is that you found not much difference between nation, not much difference between ethnicity, and you've further defined the difference between men and women. And you say, look, you can actually set a global rule here. There's not one rule for anemia for the Gambia versus Australia.
We actually used a technique called a genome-wide association study, which is a genetic study where we could compare hemoglobin concentrations across different ancestries, including people from African heritage, European, South Asian heritage, East Asian heritage. And what we could see was that, yes, there are certain genes that are more common or less common between different ancestries that influence hemoglobin concentration. But these are those that, if you're a clinician, you want to find, you know, genes that affect hemoglobin production and quality of hemoglobin production, for example. But once you take out all the conditions that you want to find with your diagnosis of anemia, there isn't really anything that should be further influencing hemoglobin concentration genetically.
So in other words, if you're in a country where there's more sickle cell anemia or glucose phosphate dehydrogenase deficiency,
G6PD, that's right.
Which is evolutionary protective against malaria, or that's what it's thought to be, their hemoglobins would be a bit lower. But you're saying even allowing for that, you can state the normal hemoglobin.
Yeah, that's right. Because what we want to do as clinicians is, if we meet a patient from a different ancestral background, if they do turn out to have a lower hemoglobin and be anemic, we don't want to be blind to that. We want to then be able to go on and work out what that might be. Even if the cause is a genetic condition that's common and not necessarily serious, we still want to know what's there, because that might, for example, have connotations for their children down the track.
Let's now move to people listening to this in terms of their own hemoglobin. And as you say, if it's dropping and it's dropped below what's normal, now it's much clearer what's normal. There are all sorts of things. You've got to look for bleeding. Have you got a bowel cancer or a polyp that's bleeding in your bowel? That sort of thing. Does this make it any clearer when to treat anemia?
I think the first thing is it makes it consistent when to diagnose anemia. Even in Australia, you could go to one doctor in one laboratory and be diagnosed as anemic, and go to the next one next door and actually have a non-anemic diagnosis. So firstly, we feel that our evidence will allow a consistent application of that, which will mean that patients can be treated consistently. One important point you picked up on there, the first step when someone's anemic is to work out why. And that's crucial, because there are multiple causes of anemia: iron deficiency, a disorder of the genetics of the red blood cell, red cell breakdown, or other nutritional deficiencies, inflammation. Now that we have a consistent definition of anemia, all those secondary tests that need to be done to work out why someone is anemic can be applied consistently, and that should simplify treatment. And then in terms of how you go about treating, I think firstly that we would always link treatment to the underlying cause. There's no point treating a patient who doesn't have iron deficiency with iron, and vice versa. If someone does have iron deficiency, it's critical to try to figure out why that might be. If it's a woman, does she have heavy menstrual bleeding? If it's a man, is there a bleeding disorder or something bleeding in the colon? So there's a lot of thinking that needs to happen after all these initial steps are made. But in terms of your question around transfusion, yes, there's certainly an increasing recognition that patients actually tolerate anemia a little bit better than previously thought. And depending on the particular scenario and how the patient is going in themselves, we can often defer a blood transfusion even down to a hemoglobin of 70 in an otherwise fit person. And you're right as well that we would prefer, if a patient has iron deficiency anemia, which is probably the most common cause of iron deficiency even in Australia, that we use iron directly rather than a blood transfusion, unless there's a very critical complicating scenario.
Another of the controversies with anemia is, what level do symptoms get triggered? So, for example, people blame fatigue on anemia. They'll blame breathlessness on anemia. Is there a trigger point for clinical symptoms, or it's just so woolly you can't say?
There are a multitude of symptoms and impacts from anemia, and they affect different patients with different additional medical conditions at different levels. So we weren't able to do that as part of this analysis.
So what's the bottom line for those listening?
I think the bottom line is that with the work that we've done, we're able to help doctors, laboratories that diagnose anemia, and public health officials around the world apply a consistent set of rules to how they diagnose anemia. We should simplify care for patients and also from a public health perspective, help us improve the health of populations right around the world.
Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Professor Sandrine Pasricha, who is a haematologist at the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute, the Royal Melbourne Hospital and the Peter MacCallum Cancer Institute.
And just for clarity, for anyone wondering, it's P-E-E-L-Y hyphen W-A-L-L-Y.
P-E-E-L-Y. That's right. You're listening to The Health Report.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.